Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, featuring spectacular plant displays and inspiring public programs year-round. Learn more at bbg.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, schools, cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years and we're just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good evening, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liut, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Now that it is officially fall and school is back in session, I thought it would be quite timely to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is, of course, school lunch. And to help me do so today is Jennifer Gaddis, Assistant Professor of Civil Society and Community Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's also the author of the forthcoming book, The Labor of Lunch, Why We Need Real Food and Real Jobs in American Public Schools. And I'm so pleased it's brought her to the show today. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thanks for having me, Jenna.
Absolutely. So, love your book. Super excited to tell everybody all about it. My first question for you is that you, so you're a professor of civil society and community studies. I mean, do you have a background in food, or why did you decide to write about?
And nobody ever knows what that is. So I'm in a very interdisciplinary department. I would say that the thing that really is common between me and some of the other faculty in the department is that we're all really dedicated to doing action-oriented research. So I would say that this kind of core of doing activist scholarship is what unites us all together, but mm-hmm. we bring lots of different training to the table. So my own background is actually in environmental studies. Okay. So I came to the study of the National School Lunch Program largely because I was really interested in farm-to-school programs and how that could potentially help local farmers and also help with some of the environmental impact of school lunch. And it was really through the first kind of months of field work where I was really spending time out on farms, but also in school kitchens and in distribution facilities, kind of trying to get a lay of the land, that I really fell in love with just spending time in the kitchens and talking to the workers there. And I would say that I sort of moved a little bit further into the food studies side of things versus environmental studies as my work progressed. And mm-hmm. As I really got to learn more about the issues, I would say that I really couldn't stay in this box of environmental studies. I had to really learn a lot about labor, and I had to really learn a lot about American history, and I had to really learn a lot about all sorts of things in order to kind of make sense of where we are now and where we could potentially go in the future. So environmental studies is kind of my core area, and I think I bring a lot of that to my analysis, but I would say I have a really deep love for the kind of women's history, gender mm-hmm. studies side of things, and the labor studies side as well.
Yeah, and that, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, but like the sort of feminist politics was a core theme in your book, and also like the intersectionality yeah. of feminist politics with labor issues, with the environmental issues, with health. And so there's a lot to unpack here. I feel like it was a big undertaking. But yeah. okay. So then, I mean, so in your goal in writing this, was this to kind of elevate the profile of the school food worker itself, or like what was your kind of, as you started to unpeel the layers, like what was your driving force behind really putting forth this this work?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that my main motivation is to really introduce kind of a different angle to conversations about school lunch reform. So I think that there are a lot of people who are doing really wonderful work trying to get school gardens in schools, trying to develop farm-to-school programs, trying to convert like heat-and-serve programs where a lot of what they're doing is just unboxing and baking foods that are made in faraway factories, like converting that to scratch cooking. Like there's a lot of like really great energy that's very much focused on the food itself. Mm-hmm. And I think that sometimes what can get lost in the conversation is the role that workers and the kind of labor structure that's been built into the National School Lunch Program, like that piece, I think really needs to be changed in order for us to really realize the full potential of the program. Because one of the things I noticed pretty quickly as I was visiting schools is that there might be a whole lot of energy and a whole lot of intent behind wanting to source local foods, for example. But if they aren't set up to cook from scratch, so if they right. don't have a kitchen is set up with the right kind of equipment, and if they don't have workers who are hired for enough hours to actually be doing that work, they're pretty much dependent on just purchasing foods that can be reheated and served very, very easily. And it's very difficult for them to start making these values-based purchases and saying, we actually want to support like our local food and farm economies through these public dollars that we're in charge of through our school food expenditures. So I think I was very interested in drawing attention to that as kind of a missing link. And I think that even though there are, I think, a fair number of people really talking about scratch cooking now, more so than when I started doing the research for the book 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think that there's still this missing piece where the workers are really oftentimes considered, like, I think, an afterthought in a lot of ways, yeah. where there's this kind of trade-off between, well, do we want to spend more money on higher quality ingredients, or do we want to make sure that workers are actually earning a livable wage and having benefits and things of that nature? And I think that it's really important for us to focus on both of those aspects of food justice at once. One of the things that I think is really important to recognize, especially if we're thinking about school food as a place to not only feed children high quality food, but to also be shaping their tastes like in the future. Mm-hmm. A lot of the research that looks at, well, how do you actually get kids to eat unfamiliar vegetables, says that it's very important for kids to actually have a positive experience when they're being introduced to new foods. So to feel like cared for and to actually feel like they know the person who's feeding them and have a positive relationship with them. So it's really important that workers can actually afford to stay in their cafeteria jobs to make those long-term relationships with kids happen.
Yeah. What is the, and certainly one of the things I really liked about this book was that it definitely provided, obviously, like not only just a extensive history of who has been feeding children for, over a century in this country, but in today's day and age, I think the school food service worker is fairly, I don't want to say demonized, that's not right, the right word, but like sort of like bears the brunt of, it's like school food is awful and it's the school food service worker's fault. And that's obviously not true. But I do think this was like a refreshing kind of take on like, look at all of the, what the kind of the role was originally did and what a lot of school food service workers want to be able to continue to do in terms of like comprehensive care.
Well, I think that was one of the things you asked earlier, you know, what made me want to write this book. And I think one of the core things that made me want to write the book and to write it in this way is to really honor a lot of the kitchen and cafeteria workers that I interviewed and that I spent hours, like, observing in school kitchens and talking to, because they would often tell me that they wanted to be cooking for the kids. They wanted to be making foods that they were excited and proud to serve the kids. But oftentimes that's not what they, you know, were being paid to do, right?
And or have the capabilities to do, whether that's like equipment or technical skills.
And I think another piece of it too is the idea of lunch shaming. So lunch debt that students might accrue if they don't qualify for free lunches, then leading to these kind of punitive actions like serving kids like a cold cheese sandwich or like taking their tray away and throwing it away in front of everyone. Like those kinds of things, I think, have generated a fair amount of outrage in the news lately. But, you know, sometimes I'll see these stories written in such a way in newspapers or online outlets that talk about individual lunch ladies doing these things, almost as if, like, you know, these lunch ladies want to be doing this, which is not at all like
the rogue lunch lady.
Yeah. And I think that one thing we have to recognize is that, you know, it's a challenging job. Not only is it a very physically demanding job, oftentimes, like, it's a lot of repetitive motion. Kitchens, particularly where they are doing scratch cooking, like, they can be very hot. A lot of the work can be, like, quite just physically taxing. But then when you actually go to the serving line, you know, some kids are excited to see you and are really, like, polite, and others, you know, maybe not so much. But you have to kind of maintain your composure and try to be kind to the children that are coming through the lunch line. Mm-hmm. And then at the cafeteria space, you know, a lot of the workers that I talk to, you know, they're there because they really care about the children that they're feeding. A lot of them started working in school kitchens and cafeterias in part because their own children might have gone to those very same schools, or at least a school in that district. So, you know, they have a connection to the children that they're feeding. And so when they are told, you know, this kid is coming through the line, and if they don't have money in their account, you have to give them a cheese sandwich or take away their lunch tray and throw it in the trash. Like, that's not something that the workers are wanting to do, right?
Right.
Like, that's a policy that somebody else has created, that they're the ones who have to enforce and then have to kind of suffer the emotional consequences of that. So I think that in popular media, sometimes lunch ladies are portrayed as being mean or crabby, and I think that that's certainly not always the case. I think that there are a lot of cafeteria workers who, you know, despite all the odds against them, they, like, really maintain a very positive attitude and are very kind to the children. But there are some, for sure, maybe not always, but on, like, particular days, who are crabby. And I think part of it is because they have to kind of create this emotional shield to protect themselves a little bit from being so close to these kids that they can't always care for in the way that they would like to.
Yeah. All right. So let's look at, like, can you help us, can you unpack a little bit about, like, paint a picture of who these workers are? So you write that the majority of school food workers are women, like over 90%, right?
Yes.
And which is very surprising, but, like, how much, what are the, like, sort of the demographics, like, and how much are they working and how much are they making? And, like, you know, what are their kind of, like, educational backgrounds look like?
Sure. So I think that it's important to recognize that this is a very, very gendered occupation, and it always has been. There have been more men coming into school food service departments as some jobs really improve in terms of quality. So as an example, in Minneapolis Public Schools, which is one of the districts where I did a fair amount of research, when they transitioned from serving little pre-pack, almost like TV dinners that were made in a big central kitchen, to doing on-site cooking in the school kitchens, they went from having a lot of jobs that were only 3 or 4 hours in the middle of the day with very little room for career advancement, to having a lot more jobs that were between 6 to 8 hours, which would qualify for full-time benefits and things of that nature. And as that transition occurred and more kind of culinary skill was needed, but also like the jobs were approaching full time with benefits, they started to have a lot more men applying for those positions. So I think that that's kind of a trend that I would expect to happen in other places as the job quality improves. But the people who are kind of the core, like bread and butter, like school food service workforce, I would say that most of them do have children, or at least when they started their jobs had children. And one of the things that would be like appealing to them in terms of why working in a school cafeteria would be appealing is that the hours oftentimes match with the kind of caretaking responsibilities that they have outside of school. So the not only the hours that their kids would be off on an individual day, but kind of school vacations and summertime would match up with their work schedule, so they would be able to kind of care for their young children at home. So a fair number of people do stay in those jobs for an extended period of time, although I think that increasingly a lot of school districts have trouble with retention and recruitment, particularly of people into entry-level jobs, because as more and more schools shifted away from cooking from scratch, particularly in the 1970s and 1980s, to really relying on a lot of these ultra-processed foods, the hours that workers had available to them really shrunk. And so a lot of them were not really able to afford to stay in those jobs. And I think that's especially true today, that for many workers, this isn't just like a supplementary form of income. This is a form of income that's very necessary to support oneself and one's family.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll get to some kind of more standard statistics in just a second. But the last kind of big report that looked at overall stats for cafeteria workers is drawing from 2008 data, so it's a little outdated. But I did a survey with some workers in New Haven, Connecticut, in collaboration with the Labor Union Unite Here. And we surveyed about 200 workers, and one of the things that we found that was really surprising to me was that two-thirds of the workers we surveyed were primary providers for their families. Huh. So meaning that their income was like the most important for their family. And they were the ones that through their jobs really needed to have health insurance for their families. So I think that that's an important thing for people to recognize, is that this is a public sector job, and we need for these public sector jobs to be better quality. So we have a real jobs crisis in this country with this overproduction of like very low wage and very precarious kind of jobs that don't really allow people to care well for themselves and their families. And I think it's very important the kind of jobs that we're creating through our public institutions and public programs don't fall into that same kind of trap of like, you know, Uber and things like that.
Well, you, I mean, you write that the annual, this is a course of 2008, but you say that the annual medium income is just $9,300. I mean, is that?
Yeah. So,
that's
and
crazy.
The reason that that's true isn't because of the hourly wage being particularly low. So the median hourly wage in 2008 was $10.45, and only about 20% of workers at that point earned minimum wage. So these jobs, if you look at you know, how much workers are making on an hourly basis, oftentimes look better, certainly than jobs like in fast food. The issue is access to hours. Mm-hmm. So the median school cafeteria worker, again, in 2008, worked only 25 hours a week for 40 weeks a year. So the issue is that they're not working a very long number of hours per day. Mm-hmm. And then because they have so many like times where they're not getting paid at all when school's not in session, since they're not feeding children during that time, it's very challenging for them to make a very high yearly wage. So you asked a little bit about some of the other demographics of these workers. So back in 2008, the median age was 47. So a lot of these workers, again, would have come into schools for the most part when their children were of school age, and oftentimes would have stayed for a longer period of time. About 21% of those workers would have no high school degree, but the majority, so 54%, have like a high school degree. And what some researchers out of the UC Berkeley Labor Center found when they kind of crunched these like demographic numbers, they found that the race and ethnicity of school cafeteria workers pretty much mirrors that of the states that they're coming from. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, there, if you look at the kind of labor force as a whole, it's very gendered, but it's not particularly racialized. If you look at this group of workers that we might call school cafeteria workers. However, I will say from my own observations and interviews in school kitchens and cafeteria spaces, while like the census data maybe doesn't allow us to see this in such a fine-grained way, I think it's very true that the entry-level positions where people would be more so doing like dishwashing or serving food or in the cashier stations, and a lot of these positions that are really just like 3 to 4 hours per day, I think that those are disproportionately filled by women of color in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And it tends to be more men and white women who are in like the supervisory kind of roles.
Okay. So this, I want to back up and kind of talk about the origins of the, you know, we're talking about what cafeteria workers look like today, but talk about the origins of the National School Lunch Program. And you write that it, of course, you know, it didn't spontaneously arise in 1946. It has a long history, and one that was like feminist at that. So can you tell us a little bit about how this legislation kind of came to be? Because it was decades before anything at the federal level was enacted, right?
Yeah, so 1946 is often a year that people will point to as like the beginning of this program. And it is true that that's when the National School Lunch Act was passed and the federal government kind of created this permanently funded child nutrition program. But really, I like to think of the origins of the National School Lunch Program dating back to the 1890s. And one of my colleagues here at the University of Wisconsin, Andrew Reese, wrote a book called Eating to Learn, Learning to Eat, that's mm-hmm. all about the origins of the school lunch program. So I credit him as someone who really taught me a lot about what these early years looked like and really sparked my own interest in going back and trying to find a lot of documents and kind of learn about this history for myself. And a lot of what I found was that in the 1890s through kind of the 1910s, there were a lot of women who were very, very concerned about kind of two things at once. So one, the quality of the meals that were available to poor children in particular in urban areas. So a lot of like poor kids didn't have access to nutritious meals. This was at a time when, you know, a lot of their parents would have been working like in factories, or even like some of the children themselves, you know, would have still been employed mm-hmm. To some extent in those kinds of environments. So there was this real concern about poor children's nutrition, but then there were also a lot of middle class and upper middle class women whose children were going to school and who needed to have, you know, some sort of nutritious meal at school. And a lot of the women would sort of talk to each other and also write in to ladies' magazines expressing like how it was actually like quite challenging to, much like mothers today, I think.
Yeah.
Still talk about.
I love that. It was like, God, nothing, yeah. nothing has changed. Like the burden
people
of
people have all these expectations
and judgments about what you're sending your kids to school with in terms of food,
totally.
And that it's like, I kind of loved reading that it was like just as much a massive headache then as it is today.
Yeah, it absolutely was. And they even had like some of the same kind of issues where, you know, today people are, I think, increasingly concerned about the ingredients in food, and there's a lot of attention to real food or clean eating. Like those are, I think, terms people throw around a lot.
Yeah.
Back then, there were concerns about food being like intentionally adulterated. So with manufacturers, for instance, taking flour and putting like sawdust and, you know, things like that into it to like extend it to where it seemed like more, right? So
yeah.
It was all about this cheapening impulse of like, how do we make food cheaper and cheaper so that we as like, you know, these corporations can profit more from it. So there were a lot of concerns that these women had about the purity of the food that their children were eating. And one of the things that was kind of happening at the time was that these new sort of scientific techniques surrounding really testing food in terms of its nutritional quality, but also its purity, were starting to become more widely used. So there were these tools at bay for figuring out, you know, whether food would be safe to eat. But it was kind of challenging, again, much like today, for individual women to be doing all this work themselves to sort of vet and verify whether food was safe to feed their children.
Right.
So one of the big things that a lot of these women did was they participated in women's clubs. So these women's clubs were oftentimes concerned not only with like the charitable side of, for instance, you know, what do poor children in our communities need, but they also really thought about, you know, how do we make our lives, particularly in urban areas, safer and better for everyone. So this was kind of the same time period when public kindergartens, laundries, bathhouses, all sorts of kind of public infrastructure that we take for granted today was really being like envisioned and implemented in cities across the country. So school lunch programs were a part of that. They were this collective solution to a problem that for a long time had really been talked about as, you know, a private concern that women are supposed to deal with on their own in the household. So the innovative thing that these women did was they really tried to carve out a niche for themselves within public schools, saying, you know, we want to provide nonprofit school lunch programs. So we don't want to profit off of the sale of food to children. Mm-hmm. We just want to be able to make sure that kids can actually get access to affordable meals that are safe and nutritious and ideally tasty. So they really tried to make this kind of a woman-controlled enterprise. Yeah, so a lot of these women who might have been like the first kind of generation to graduate with university degrees in fields like home economics and dietetics, they were the ones who were sort of the professionals who would have been in charge of these early school lunch programs. And then they tried to really create jobs, particularly for women who they thought weren't well-suited for factory work, so women who were a little bit older or for some reason or another just needed access to other kinds of work. They tried to create these jobs for women in school kitchens to be able to cook and serve these nutritious meals to kids.
And so that lasted, you call that like that was like the progressive era, right?
Yeah.
And that kind of gave way to eventually, by the way, one of the things I loved, and this is a quote from, Caroline Hunt, which do you want to tell us just who she is, really quickly?
So Caroline Hunt, she actually ended up being, she was like a philosopher of the home economics movement. But she ended up actually being a very influential person who wrote a lot of documents related to school lunch and feeding children for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But she also happens to be the very first professor ever at the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, where I now teach.
So you probably are she's a big fan.
I am. And I guess, like, she was, like, just a radical woman. And I think that I love her for that because... Yeah. She was writing over 100 years ago about ethical consumption and what it means to be a conscious consumer.
Yes.
And she would really push people to think about, you know, when we're buying things as individuals, we have to think about the conditions under which those products are made. And she talked a lot about, like, solidarity and mutual aid across classes and across, like, racial lines. And so I think she was a really, like, progressive person for her era, and she did only last a few years at the university.
I like, and you're like, she was the unfair. She was the lowest paid, obviously, because some things
it's
don't
true.
Change.
And she had this really radical curriculum where she was really trying to teach people about the politics of how women could really control, like, because they were the ones who were shopping for their families, they had a lot of control over household wealth, mm-hmm. Particularly women from the middle and upper middle classes. So she was very much, like, trying to talk with them about using their money in very intentional ways.
Yeah.
And also using their additional time to do what we might now call, like, citizen science. So,
like, advocacy
would,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So advocacy stuff, but also, like, she would, like, kind of ask people who would come to the university for these kind of summer trainings. She would train them in how to test, like, milk purity, and she would also like train them on how to like test like water quality like in the rivers around Wisconsin, and then she would ask for them, you know, to report data back.
Yeah.
So it's like she was doing these things that were like very much like about like collective action and how like you know, people can make change together. And the university, after a few years, I think, decided that they wanted to go more in a direction with home economics education being more about manual skills kind of related to cooking and cleaning. What I think in the 1950s often sort of became referred to as these like stitch and stir kind of classes where you know, you learn a little bit about how to sew, you learn a little bit about how to like, you know, make very, very simple recipes,
but not like manage the home. Yeah. Like not manage the home and kind of run it like it seemed like she wanted to empower women to do.
Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah. So I love, cause you had a quote that, she talks about like cheap food capitalism and, the need to, like you said, redirect their purchasing power to ethical food companies. I just love that. Like and I think a big theme throughout this book and certainly your early chapters was just like history repeats itself.
Definitely.
Because, right, we are kind of like right back to where we started from. But, okay, which is crazy. But so this is like, you know, decades in the making, and then for 19, you know, this legislation was eventually enacted, but it was done so without the voice of women who, you know, you talk about have this frontline experience with the nonprofit school lunch movement. What were their demands, you know, and how would the program have been different today if what they were advocating for had been prioritized?
Yeah, so they had really had this kind of test opportunity to think about, well, what does it look like when we actually scale up from having these smaller initiatives, maybe in cities or in rural areas, to thinking about things at the state level and then at the federal level during the Great Depression, because during the Great Depression, the federal government first started to donate commodities, so commodity foods, to school lunch programs. And federal government also provided a lot of free labor through the Works Progress Administration. They hired a lot of poor, underemployed women to be working in these school lunch programs. So a lot of the supervisors of these state programs that had participated during the Works Progress Administration, during those school lunch programs, they had a lot of data. They sort of knew that there were certain things that were going to help a lot. So they knew on the one hand that they needed to have more public investment. So they needed to have access to more dollars from the state and federal government. They couldn't just rely on children's like fees, particularly if they needed to actually provide free lunches to all the needy children in their communities. So they knew they needed access to financial resources. They also knew that nutrition education, so money for actually teaching kids about what they were eating and
so
why
amazing.
It was good for them,
that
would make a really big difference in terms of school lunch actually being something that is helpful in the long term from like a public health perspective. They also really wanted things like school gardens, so sort of like the kind of wish list that today's reformers have, like free school lunches, school gardens, nutrition education, like that was all part of the original vision. But when it actually came to this legislation being negotiated, I would say that women were very, very influential and necessary for building a coalition and expressing popular support for the legislation. But a lot of the things that they wanted to see happen, including having the National School Lunch Program be situated in the Department of Education instead of the Department of Agriculture, did not happen. And mainly it was the interests of a lot of these politicians who really cared more about the agricultural assistance side of things. Whose concerns were listened to more so than the women who had actually been involved in the program. So that's the thing that I think sometimes just really like makes my blood boil a little bit. But like the people who were actually like there on the front lines, like you know, delivering these programs like year after year, they really got very, very little say in what the program actually would look like once it became this permanent federal legislation. And I think that one of the pieces that comes out of that as well is that there was originally some designated funding for like equipment and infrastructure. So actually, you know, the kind of like, well, we don't have kitchens. Like, how do we make them?
Right.
And that piece of the legislation went unfunded for a very long period of time after the first year. So it really put a lot of pressure on local communities to come up with the resources that they needed to create kitchen and cafeteria facilities. And as I'm sure a lot of people can imagine, there was a tremendous amount of inequality in post-war America. So a lot of the suburbs, particularly where middle-class white people lived, could afford to make this investment locally in building kitchens and cafeterias in their like newly built schools. But a lot of the urban schools that had been built in the 1920s, like in the cities, like around the U.S., and a lot of the rural areas that, you know, were quite poor, they didn't necessarily have these extra funds floating around to be making this investment at the local level. So a lot of them really got skipped over. And for the first two decades of the National School Lunch Program, there were a lot of children, particularly black children, from urban and rural America who really didn't benefit from this program at all.
So do you think that, you know, the decision to house this program under the USDA, you know, or, and like, and not the DOE. So are you saying that it was basically like more emphasis on using this program to move surplus crops in this country, which are, of course, you know, the commodity crops?
Yeah, I think that was definitely a part of it. So the National School Lunch Program, if you actually look at like the wording of the National School Lunch Act, there's essentially two primary goals. So one is to safeguard the health and well-being of the nation's children, mm-hmm. and the other is to...
It's good. That's a good place to start.
It is a good one. But the other goal is to support the domestic consumption of nutritious agricultural commodities and other foods. And of course, you know, we could debate what that actually looks like in terms of, you know, are these foods actually nutritious?
Right.
But I think that there has always been a lot of politics surrounding, you know, what these commodity foods look like. But, you know, now only about 20% of the foods that schools are actually serving come to them through the commodities program.
Oh.
They're actually purchasing a lot of it on the open market. But the problem is that they have, like, so little money to work with that it's very challenging for them to really do a whole lot other than just go with some of the cheapest options.
Well, what do these commodity, you know, can you help, like, just quickly, is this like extra corn and soy that gets processed that the schools can, you know, I don't know, like make a product from, or is it like dairy that's made into cheese? Like, what do the commodities foods look like?
There's a huge list of commodity foods that are available to schools. And it could be things as basic as, for instance, like frozen blueberries that they could then turn into smoothies or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be something as basic as like flour or peanut butter or chicken. And some schools choose to get foods in these really basic formats. Those are oftentimes referred to as brown box commodities, meaning that they just sort of show up, you know, in a brown box, and they're in this really
surprise.
Basic form.
Yeah.
Yep. And you unbox them and you use them in your recipes. But a lot of schools actually choose to do something that is basically called entering into a commodities processing agreement, where they might actually send a certain portion of their cheese to Kraft, and instead of having to like grate cheese, like a big block of cheese themselves in the school kitchen and make cheese sauce for macaroni, they can actually send that cheese. They can like tell the government, we want our cheese allocation shipped to Kraft. and then Kraft will like process it for them into any number of products that they can select from, and then they get those finished products instead. So same thing with like chicken nuggets. That could actually be commodity chicken that a company like Tyson is processing. So schools have this option of whether or not they want to send their commodities on to these like for-profit companies for further processing, and to then get like a finished product that is easier for them to just heat and serve in schools, or they can choose to get these more basic brown box commodities that I mentioned.
And you know, all of this, so complicated, right? I mean, for anyone who's like, school, it just should be so easy. We should just serve healthy food. Like, yes. And I mean, most people have no idea how complicated the like procurement process is for school food. But I think it's worth noting how much do they have, like, at the end of the day to serve a meal? The max reimbursement is like $3.50, right?
So yes, it's $3.41 is the base, and then schools can get another 7 cents per lunch if they meet the new nutrition standards from the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act of 2010, and then they can get an additional 2 cents per lunch if they're in like a high poverty school district where 60% or more of the lunches were served at free or reduced price. So
right.
Kind of what you said, like the highest that you would really see for the reimbursement that they get from the federal government would be $3.50 per meal that's served. So
what does that mean in terms of like food? How much money they actually have to serve?
It depends upon like the local labor costs. But I would say that typically having around $1 to $1.50, I think it's pretty typical. So the School Nutrition Association, they on their website, the kind of most recent data they have is from a 2008 report that the USDA did, which looked at the cost of producing school meals during the 2005-2006 school year. So again, like this data is a little bit old, but what that data showed was that the average school district was spending 37% of those reimbursement dollars on food, 48% on labor and benefits, 5% on supplies, and kind of 10% on other miscellaneous costs. So already a lot of the money is going to labor and benefits, and that's why a lot of school districts, they will rely more on heavily processed foods because it allows them to then hire workers for only a few hours and keep them below like the benefit level positions. So
right.
If you go like to your local school district and find out, for instance, like what the threshold is for qualifying for benefits, it might vary. I would say a typical number tends to be around like 6 hours for full time. Some school districts that have really strong unions, it might be closer to four. But what you kind of always end up seeing is that there are a lot of workers who typically are kind of right at this threshold. So, for example, if the threshold for benefits is 6 hours of work per day, there will be a lot of workers who have a 5.75-hour position. I think that a lot of the schools, it's like they're already spending a lot on labor and benefits. So, like food service directors, you know, they, for the most part, I would say, really would like to be paying their workers better.
Yeah.
But they're in a really tough position where, you know, labor is already a huge part of their budget, and they really can only go so low in terms of the food costs because they have to serve meals that meet the nutrition requirements, and they have to serve like a particular quantity of food. So the fact that they're even able to do like what they are able to do in some school districts
is amazing.
I go to some of these school districts where they actually have really robust like farm to school programs and do a lot of scratch cooking, and the fact that they're able to make it work with the kind of reimbursement dollars that we currently have is pretty amazing to me.
Okay, so we're going to take a really quick commercial break, but when we get back, I want to talk a little bit about the privatization era, which happened pretty quickly right after, seems like really fast after the legislation was enacted, and then kind of where we are today and where we need to go. So stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, featuring spectacular plant displays and inspiring public programs year-round. Harvest Homecoming, an old-school fall foliage festival, comes to Brooklyn Botanic Garden on Sunday, October 20th. Celebrate cider season with New York cider houses and kombucha makers, bringing hard and soft ciders and fermented drinks to try or buy. A pop-up farmers market will feature heritage apples from local orchards. Groove to the sounds of fresh Americana music and world beats throughout the day. Bring your friends and family and make a day of it with hay rides, lawn games, a children's Halloween costume parade, and more, all in the heart of Brooklyn. Learn more about Brooklyn Botanic Garden at bbg.org.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Dave Arnold, and I'm the host of Cooking Issues here on Heritage Radio Network. Every week, I answer listeners' questions on the latest innovative techniques, equipment, and ingredients in the food world. Have a question about hot rotting your oven to make great pizza? Give us a call. Hydrocolloid, sous vide, liquid nitrogen? No problem. You can find Cooking Issues wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Jennifer Gaddis about her new book, The Labor of Lunch, published by the University of California Press, soon to be released. Jennifer, before the break, I said that we are going to talk about privatization. We talked, I guess, initially about kind of the history behind how this legislation, the National School Lunch Program, what led to it being enacted. It was enacted, and then seemingly very shortly thereafter, it started to privatize. And this was originally something that wasn't allowed, right? Like, it was in the initial legislation, right. It was very clear that schools couldn't outsource management of their programs.
So the one big win that the women who did so much to create these early school lunch programs got from the federal government when this legislation was created was this promise that these school lunch programs would be nonprofit and that schools would not be contracting with for-profit vendors. So any kind of for-profit entity would not be allowed in the schools. So that changed in the late 1960s. Early 1970s, when all those children who had really been excluded from participating in the National School Lunch Program, particularly in urban and rural areas, there was a lot of attention by the anti-hunger movement and again by this group of women working together who really uncovered systematic racism in the National School Lunch Program in terms of how it had been rolled out across the country. And they sort of said, we have to do something to address this, and we have to do something to address this very quickly. And so there was this real need to scale up the National School Lunch Program very quickly, and particularly to expand it to schools that didn't have any kitchen or cafeteria facilities. So a lot of these food companies had been sort of, ignoring school lunch for a while because it didn't necessarily seem like a huge, lucrative kind of market segment. But as the baby boomers started coming to school, population numbers swelled and they started to see more of this profit potential. And they also started to sort of recognize it as a real place where they could start to cultivate children's tastes and sort of brand identity early on. So school lunch became a more culturally and also economically important place for the food industry. So what ended up happening was the National Restaurant Association, which sometimes food activists refer to as the other NRA, started lobbying the federal government to say you have to drop this restriction on food service management companies. So listeners today, food service management companies, the ones that they might know most are Aramark, Chartwell, Sodexo. So those are kind of the big three to operate in schools today. But there are a lot of smaller, more regional ones as well. So a lot of these not only management companies, but also frozen food manufacturers wanted to really get their foot in the door in schools. So they sort of said, hey, you have this problem where you need to figure out how to feed a really large number of people all at once, and you need to figure out how to do it in tiny spaces that were never really built for doing this. So a lot of the expertise from the airline industry actually like played a pretty big role in figuring out how to deliver food to schools. And these little pre-packed meals, like what you currently still get on airlines, became a really important like technology for like food delivery in urban schools. And from there, it just kind of became this slippery slope to you know, more and more processed foods in schools. And then there were these additional legislative changes that started to allow soda and like fast food companies to really set up shop.
The competitive foods.
Exactly. Yep. And a lot of these foods that, you know, are salty, fatty, crunchy, sweet, you know, things that if kids aren't necessarily like qualifying for free or reduced price lunches and are just choosing what to spend their money on might be more enticing from a taste perspective started to be allowed in schools. And I think that this piece about privatization and really the kind of cheapening of school lunch, it really was amplified in the 1980s by some of the just tremendous budget cuts that the Reagan administration made to the National School Lunch Program. So we're talking like, you know, a quarter of the budget being cut.
Wow.
So this is like for listeners who maybe are of that generation, like the ketchup as a vegetable era of school lunch policy. And today I think there's still pressure on some schools to outsource their lunch programs, particularly if their lunch programs are not financially self-sustaining, because unlike pretty much any other aspect of a school system, school food service is expected to be financially self-sustaining based on not only the reimbursements from the federal government, but also the revenue that they get from children who are paying like for the full-priced meal. So, you know, we don't charge kids for math class or English or anything like that, but we charge them differently based on their family income for school lunch. So schools that don't make their finances work, they oftentimes come under pressure of, well, you know, if we can't make it work ourselves, we're going to contract with one of these management companies because they're going to be able to like kind of get us back in line is sort of how the thinking goes. And I personally like tend to be pretty critical of the management companies, in part because these are nonprofit programs. So I think that anytime you are contracting your lunch program out to like a
for-profit entity.
It's like a global, like it's not even, you know, some like little mom and pop for-profit entity. These are, you know, multinational corporations. Like they have a profit interest and they're making profit somehow on this program. So usually it's through finding ways to reduce labor costs and to reduce food costs. So anytime we have this like for-profit motive, I do wonder like, you know, how are they actually managing to make a profit in this nonprofit space? So part of it might be economy of scale. So purchasing the same kind of foods for like all the different, you know, school lunch programs that they manage. But I think that the problem there is that that really goes against, I think, some of the current trends of people really wanting to have more localized school food supply chains, like participating in farm to school, purchasing from local providers. So I think that really
it's not incentive to do that. Yeah,
I think there's some issues with the privatization piece. But even, you know, today the School Nutrition Association, which is the major like trade organization that represents school food service directors, managers, cafeteria staff, like they have a really close relationship with big food manufacturers that I think can sometimes be problematic in terms of the policy positions that the School Nutrition Association ends up taking.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess, okay, so I have two questions. I have a lot of questions, but my first thinking was that just to sort of like summarize, it sounds like there was never enough funding for this legislation. Like,
I think that that's 100% true, and I think a lot of that has to do with it being like very much like a form of gendered work. It's very, very similar to what mothers are doing at home on an unpaid basis, and so I think that it was always like economically devalued.
Yeah, and so okay, so never enough. I mean, because even and you write just like states have to contribute. Is that still true that states have to contribute money to the school food like budget for those schools in their states, and that kind of exacerbates a lot of economic inequities?
it has really changed a lot since that was the case. So now it really is states can contribute like optionally, but they are not required to do so.
Okay. So not enough funding to begin with. And so does this mean that a lot of kitchens and like the initial infrastructure that would be needed for scratch cooking, was that never really created to begin with?
Correct. Yep.
And so my next question is, like, was there ever a golden era of, like, school food as, you know, we would love to see it? Like, fresh scratch cooking, you know, paying school food service workers a livable wage and that being, like, a very valued kind of position in the school environment, like, healthy meals. Was there ever a time where we got it right?
I think it really depends upon where you live, you know. Huh, I think that as a federal program, like if we're looking at the nation as a whole, I don't really think there's ever been a time where we've gotten it right. I think that there's always been a lot of inequality, and I think that the program has always been really underfunded at the kind of national level. I do think that people at the local level have like managed to create some really fantastic school lunch programs. And I think that historically there have been some states, Louisiana is an example, that had for a long time really contributed a lot more to like worker training and investing in like scratch cooking infrastructure, in part because, you know, there's a really strong food culture there. And like people, I think, felt very strongly about maintaining like children's access to like a fresh cooked like meal, you know? So I think that there were particular states where, like, if you would go, you know, from one school to the next, you might find some really great meals and, like, the kind of scratch cooking that I think a lot of people would want to see today. But I don't think that at the federal level we've ever really had it right.
So my next question has to do, I mean, and I think, like, the privatization and, like, the role of big food you know, is very important to like recognize as a driver of why, you know, the program maybe is at least in part where it is today. But we are in a very interesting time where we are seeing not just nothing happening at the federal level, but like a rollback of all of the kind of like, you know, progressive gains that were hard fought and won over the past decade or so. And so in response, I think that we are seeing certainly in some industries, like, you know, big companies, industry step up and sort of fill that gap in terms of like doing the right thing. I'm thinking recently with like the, you know, the car manufacturers wanting to proceed with the air pollution, right? Like restrictions from California that were enacted. So this is a long-winded way of asking, like, do you see any movement in the food industry trying to kind of, like, do the right thing, especially as it relates to school food? Or is it just, like, they're not really set up to make a change?
Yeah, I think, so this is something that I go into depth with in Chapter 3 of my book, like, trying to look at how there are a fair number of food companies that are trying to reformulate their products to remove what people often in the industry refer to as ingredients of concern and to make clean labels. Yeah. So, you know, to remove like the high fructose corn syrup, the artificial additives, like things of that nature. And I think that that's definitely a big trend, like in the school lunch marketplace. So the School Nutrition Association, at their big annual conference, they always have a school food show where different vendors come and they kind of set up their products and they try to convince like the purchasers for the food service.
It's like a trade
program.
Show. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
You know, to purchase their products. And I first went to one of those in 2012. So right as the like new Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act like standards were going into effect, and then I went back about 5 years later, and there was like a total transformation in terms of like the language that people were using and the kind of products that companies were trying to highlight. It was definitely shifting in this direction of like the industry like trying to present itself as like cleaning up its like supply chain and ingredient list. I think that there are certainly some companies that I think are really kind of greenwashing themselves and trying to present this like mirage of healthfulness, where, you know, they're just reformulating a couple products and they have a bunch of other things in their product portfolio that are just like their standard conventional offerings that have tons of chemicals and things like that in them. And then there are other companies that I think are taking it a lot more seriously. But I would say that my own like personal opinion is that it's great that schools are getting access to higher quality industrial foods that they can easily just plug into their kind of existing operations, just reheating and serving. But I think that that needs to be just maybe like a temporary place for school districts to sort of use to improve their lunch programs, but it really should never be the end, because I think if we end up relying on these food companies to just reformulate their products, we're not going to really be doing what we can in terms of directing public dollars to like local food producers. So farm to school programs aren't really benefited in that kind of way, and we're still trapping like, you know, thousands of women in these very short hour jobs where they really can't afford to care for their own families on the wages that they bring home from caring for children at school. So I think that a lot of things like start to become possible, like for instance having like school gardens actually growing stuff that then is used in school cafeterias, and you know, doing things that are really I think getting at the educational potential of school lunch, I think becomes a lot more possible when we invest in a much more holistic way of envisioning like school lunch reform.
Mm-hmm.
So you actually had asked about this golden era of school lunch. And at first I was thinking there wasn't one, but I actually want to revise my answer.
Yeah.
Because I think that if I'm really thinking about it, during that time period of the Great Depression, when there was this real emphasis on communities, like, you know, using their school lunch programs to not only benefit the children, but also a lot of places would set up, you know, community feeding facilities or community canning facilities. There was this real emphasis on like shared infrastructure. There was a lot of gardening going on at schools and also like at the community scale. And there was like public investment in not only kitchen infrastructure, but on hiring workers, both women and youth, to work in these programs. So I think that if I had to choose a golden era, it would actually be then, because I think that like sort of New Deal legislation, you know, now people are talking about like a Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. I think that that really probably was the golden era, because it really allowed for a much more community-focused approach to developing school lunch programs. And with the school garden component, I think that that was really huge in getting fresh food into schools in an inexpensive way and in a way that really involved children in, you know, learning about food through this act of producing food for their school lunches.
I was surprised to learn the volume of food that those gardens were producing at the time.
And that's something that, like, I wish I knew, like, what really happened to the gardens, because I feel like there's not, like, a great historical record of that.
Yeah. Well, can you remind me, what is the total amount? I mean, but I was, like, blown away.
I don't remember off the top of my head, but I can pull it up.
A lot.
It was a lot. Yes. Yeah. It was a lot. And I think that rather than finding the particular number, I will say that I think the thing that is important to recognize is that by actually creating like the infrastructure and the investment in community gardens, what we were able to do as a nation is to really reduce like dietary health like disparities, like the quality of people's diet, you know, based on income. It really started to look very much the same by the end of World War II, because of rationing and because of like all of this like food really being grown in community and school gardens and also in private like home kind of victory gardens.
Yeah, it was amazing. Okay, so we have to wrap up really quickly, but I would say, and this is a hard question to ask you to summarize, but in terms of like where we want to go, what are some of the like takeaways from this book that you want readers to know to kind of like activate around?
I think the big thing is I really want people to understand that we can't ignore school kitchen and cafeteria workers if we want to have really robust school lunch reform. I think another thing is I want people to understand like the sort of feminist history of school lunch and to reclaim it as like a feminist issue and sort of the forefront of feminist food politics, in part because, you know, 30 million children participate in the National School Lunch Program every day, but there's another 20 million who are eligible, who have access to the program at their schools, who are bringing lunches from home. And it's disproportionately people who identify as women who are making those lunches.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, there's all these studies that show that women, especially if they're working like outside of the home, really don't have nearly as much leisure time as men. And you
like
know,
still to this day.
Yes. Yeah. To this day. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we can start to do is to think about, well, how can we actually, you know, as a country, invest more in collectively caring for children and collectively caring for the elderly. And some of the things that I really take away as being just these like points of inspiration from the history of school lunch is, for example, like in the 1970s, there were some really cool, like very innovative things that school districts were doing to set up elderly feeding programs in their school kitchens. And, you know, there's so many women today who I think face this dual pressure of not only caring for kids, but also caring for, like, aging parents. So I think the more we can think about how to create these spaces in our communities that are serving really high-quality food in ways that meet, like, community needs, the better. And so I really would say that one of the things I want the book to do is to... number one, like help people who kind of work in these programs better understand their own history. This is definitely a workforce in schools that has tended to be more overlooked than teachers, for instance, like when it comes to like collective like organizing and unionization. But I also really want for a lot of the women who are currently spending time making lunches for their own children to take to school every day to realize, much like, you know, women 100-plus years ago did, that there's a better way to do it, right? Like, we can actually create really high-quality school lunch programs that kind of take some of the pressure off of women to be making these perfect little, you know, lunch boxes
Bento box lunches with, I mean, you know, whatever. Like,
that's one thing I'll say is, like, you know, since you bring up the bento box, I spent a month in Japan doing field work this summer because my next book project is going to look at school lunch programs in international context.
I cannot wait to read that, by the way.
Yeah, I have to have you back.
Yeah.
So I did some interviews with moms in Japan, and in Japan, they have this real emphasis on not only food education, but also scratch-cooked lunches and making sure that the lunches are really introducing children to a lot of traditional Japanese foods and a really wide range of just variety of different kinds of like fruits and vegetables and just dishes. And these moms would say that they just really appreciated their school lunch program because they knew that the dietitians there were doing a lot of work to make sure that the quality of the food was really good. They were also doing a lot of work to get local food into the schools. The Japanese government, their goal for schools is for them to serve a minimum of 30% locally sourced food.
Wow.
And some of the schools that I went to that are kind of at the forefront of their local food movement were serving higher than an average of 75% locally sourced food in their school meals.
That's amazing.
The moms like really appreciated that they could rely on the schools for, you know, doing this taste education, teaching the kids about like where food comes from, like all sorts of things like through the school meal, because it really reduced some of the pressure that they felt like in the evenings surrounding like meal provisioning. Like they would still cook, but they could make like kind of simpler things because they knew that their children had had these things that were maybe a little bit more complex to make for lunch when they were at school.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting just in terms of like how they really talked about appreciating their school lunch program, whereas in the States, if you
it's
ask
like shame.
Like an average mom, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. you write about how like this doesn't really work. I mean, it's not that it doesn't work, but you really need the participation of kind of everybody to get on the same page and to kind of have that, like, I don't know, is it like collective, like the funding, but also the support behind, you know, everybody's going to eat school lunch and it's going to be better because of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a couple things going on. So one is, individual kids, I think, can feel like shame and stigma around eating school lunch when other people aren't eating it in their cafeteria. So like the meals that kids are eating can start to kind of code them as being poor or not. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's also this issue of certainly finances. It takes a certain amount of money just to like make your school lunch program function, and the higher your participation. So if you can get more kids to participate, kind of the more money you have to work with, because you've kind of covered some of your basic expenses already. So increasing participation really makes a huge difference in terms of the viability of making school lunch programs better, because it gives more resources to the food service directors to work with. And then I think at the kind of larger scale, we've had so many middle-class and upper-middle-class parents opt out of the program really beginning in the 1970s, that I think it's been a real challenge to generate the political will to really create, I think, the kind of school lunch program that we need in this country. So I think right now there's, there was a ton of work that went into the nutrition reforms of the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act, and there are definitely a lot of people and organizations who are working just to make sure that those standards don't get rolled back any further. But I think that, you know, that's not necessarily the kind of change that really inspires people. So I think it's time to like really think boldly and organize together to create the kind of school lunch program that any parent would be excited for their kid to participate in.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, I think we're going to have to leave it there. But just quickly, where can your book is due out in November? Is that right?
Yeah. In November.
I've got the inside scoop. I'm so excited about it. Go on.
Thank you so much for having me on for like asking great questions and letting me babble a little bit. So the book will be out in November, and it's available for pre-order through University of California Press. And I think there's like a 30% like discount thing that you can get there. And I know it's also at Amazon. And I'm trying to do some stuff like in advance. So if people are into Twitter, I am on Twitter, and I'm trying to kind of talk about some of these issues there in a more focused way. So I'd love to have people join me in that conversation.
Amazing. All right. Well, thank you so much. I also can't wait to have you back on when you finish your next book. I'm so excited
Really appreciate it, Jenna.
Thanks. Okay. I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support, as well as our Eating Matters intern, Devaney Latino. And thanks, of course, to the one and only Cheat Paul, the best engineer ever. Show music's by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast wherever they're found. If you haven't done so already, subscribe, leave me a comment, let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right-hand side of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.